Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Have a ton of questions about LASIK? You're not alone. That's why we created LASIK.com, one place where you can go to find every answer to every question on your mind. Like, how much does LASIK cost? How long does recovery take? How do I find a doctor? If you've been thinking about LASIK, go to LASIK.com now. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. Each episode will feature a new guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the podcast. So today I'm really excited to have Dr. Andrew Neuberg on the show. Andy is a neuroscientist who studies the relationship between brain function and various mental states. He is a pioneer in the neurological study of religious and spiritual experiences, a field known as neurotheology. His research includes taking brain scans of people in prayer, meditation, rituals, and trance states in an attempt to better understand the nature of religious and spiritual practices and attitudes. His latest books are How God Changes Your Brain and How Enlightenment Changes Your Brain. Thanks so much for talking with me today, Andrew.
Oh, thanks, Scott. Thanks for having me on your program.
Wow, you study some pretty hefty topics. You know, have you always sort of thought at this kind of really existential, deep level? Like, as a kid, were you fascinated with these kinds of questions?
I think I really was. You know, it's something that when I was a kid, I was always asking questions. And, you know, it was funny. I was very disturbed by the fact that there were people who had different religions or different political, you know, different political parties and perspectives, of course, very relevant today. You know, I felt like, well, if we're all looking at the same world, how come we all haven't come to the same conclusion? Shouldn't there be some uniform answer that we all come to? And clearly, I mean, when you do look at religious traditions and cultures and political parties, you know, not only do they see the world a little differently, it's almost completely dichotomous in terms of how they look at the world. So I started to think about it, and I try to understand what was going on and why that would be the case. And first I thought about, well, it must have something to do with our brain because that's what helps us to look at the world and figure things out and try to make sense of our world. So that was the first step. And I looked at science and I looked at what science tells us about the world. But after a little while, I realized that science is also performed by us as human beings. And so it's still subjected in many ways to our own biases and the ways in which we look at the world and the ways in which we think we can measure the world. And I started to reflect inwardly about these questions, and it became a much more philosophical process, something that became almost a kind of philosophical meditation, so that I was actually just spending my time thinking about these big questions about the nature of reality and who we are and how we can understand anything about the world. And as I went through that process, it was really the combination of both these kind of philosophical meditations as well as the scientific pursuits that kept trying to kind of find a way to come together in my own mind. And ultimately, I was very fortunate that it came together in a field, this field of neurotheology. I found two wonderful mentors, one in the world of imaging of the brain, and we did studies of all different kinds of, you know, brain states and disorders and so forth. And another colleague who was looking at the same kind of questions about the relationship between religion and the human brain. And kind of going back, we realized that we could actually start to use these brain scans to study this and put this all together. And that was really what ultimately kind of put the whole idea of neurotheology together for us and was something that allowed us to go forth and try to explore these questions in a very complex and very rich way.
Sure. Are you one of the founders of the field of neuro? What is it called?
Neurotheology?
Theology. Are you one of the founders?
Well, you know, I don't know if I would say that. Interestingly, the term neurotheology actually originated with Aldous Huxley in a novel he wrote called The Island back in 1961, where he just mentions it as a term. My late mentor, Eugene DeQuilly, was perhaps one of the founders of the idea of neurotheology, of putting together the relationship between the brain and religion. And there was also a scholar named James Ashbrook, who actually was the first person I'm aware of who actually published an academic article in a peer-reviewed journal that carried the title of neurotheology. So I don't know if I was the founder, but I certainly hope that I've helped to push the field along and really try to expand it and get it into many different domains, as I feel it should be, a very multidisciplinary kind of field and field of scholarship.
Yeah. And so before you set your sights on enlightenment, you worked with Mark Waldman to study just religious beliefs. Is that right?
Yes. So, you know, my early work was looking at a variety of practices like meditation and prayer. We studied people speaking in tongues, and we studied Brazilian mediums and trance states, really trying to get a sense as to what was going on during these practices and the different experiences that they ultimately had as part of those practices.
Right. And then when did you start thinking like, okay, now I want to study like Nirvana?
Well, I think part of it came from the fact that's part of what these people often experience. People start to describe for us these incredible experiences, these mystical experiences. And in many ways, they're the culmination of these practices. We are, you know, obviously we always have this notion of the Buddhist monk who spends, 40 years of his life and then finally hits enlightenment. So it's through these practices that people have these incredibly intense experiences. So that was part of it. And part of it also grew out of this growing concern that I had that as we continued to do brain scans, and we've done now over about 250 brain scans of people doing all these practices, I kept thinking to myself that, I really don't have a good handle on the subjective nature of these experiences. So, we've heard of what Buddha had to say about the experience, or what some, very learned monks and masters had to say about it, or, some of the great Christian mystics or Jewish Kabbalistic mystics. But what do people feel? And so part of what ultimately led us to exploring the concept of enlightenment was an online survey that we ran where we asked people about their most intense spiritual experiences, their most intense enlightenment experiences. And we actually ran it when I started at the University of Pennsylvania. I was on faculty there. And we started to get all kinds of data. We got data on almost 2,000 people who gave narratives about the experiences that they have, told us about who they were, their religious and spiritual tradition, their background, what they believe, what medications they were on, what mental and physical illnesses they may have had. So we got all of this data, which is really a treasure trove of data, and we're still working through it today, that told us a lot about the subjective nature of these enlightenment experiences. And then by using that information, we could then go back to the brain scans and say, oh, okay, well, when people say that they have this incredible feeling of joy, of overwhelming joy and love, what's going on in the brain? And then we find that when people have that kind of an experience through a practice such as, for example, loving kindness meditation, then what we see are changes of activity going on in the emotional centers of the brain, in the reward centers of the brain, those areas of the brain that make us feel really, really good, make us feel very, very positively in terms of our emotion. And so again, we started to put all of that together, which led to the discussion about how enlightenment changes your brain.
Mm. So do you think we were designed by evolution to find spiritual experiences rewarding?
Well, I think that ultimately, the answer to that is yes. I mean, when you think about how these experiences come about, how they help human beings to function and understand the world in very, very intense ways, I think it does make some sense that these experiences would evolve within us. Now, part of what was also an important part of our approach to neurotheology, which was based on my late colleague Gene DeQuilly's work in anthropology, was the notion that to some degree, these experiences are built upon our brain and what our brain is trying to do for us in general. And part of that process has to do with various rituals and in particular, mating rituals. And so the idea that you know, the conclusion of the mating ritual of the sexual orgasm, for example, which is this incredible ecstatic experience, it's not surprising that religious and spiritual rituals will ultimately kind of access some of those same basic feelings and lead to ecstatic experiences. I mean, it's very interesting to me how the most intense spiritual experiences and sexual experiences are described using a lot of very similar terms. So whether or not these processes evolved in our brain for mating and for creating cohesive societies, which ultimately led to these experiences, and then once these experiences happen, we developed into these, wound up having our brain evolve even more to be able to have those experiences. It's not totally clear exactly what led to what, but certainly the idea that through the evolutionary processes that allow our brain to help us to survive, to help us to basically move from one stage of being, one stage of life to the next, religious and spiritual experience seem to fit very well into that whole process.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense that we're playing off these drives that we share with other animals. So let's step back a second. I want to ask you, like, what is enlightenment?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, when we first started to think about this as a topic, we kind of came at it as, okay, it's you know, the Buddhist monk who has this incredible experience. But as we got into it, first of all, just historically, what's interesting is that enlightenment has meant different things even on a historical level. So for the religious and spiritual, enlightenment meant the idea of truly understanding God and being intimately connected to God. In fact, perhaps even becoming one with God, as people have described in some of the mystical sects of Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. In the Buddhist and Hindu perspective, enlightenment actually didn't involve God so much as it involved the ability for us to connect to some greater universal consciousness. You mentioned sort of that nirvana experience, becoming one with everything, becoming one with the universe. But interestingly, if you go back to the 1700s and 1800s, the age of enlightenment actually was in many ways completely the opposite of this. The idea was to actually go away from religion and to turn to rational thought and science and investigation of the natural world as the process that led to a kind of intellectual enlightenment and the idea of getting beyond these archaic concepts of religion and spirituality, which were actually shrouding us in darkness and trying to come into the light through rational thought processes. So, I mean, and that is in ultimately what enlightenment means is to bring light to something. So for the religious or spiritual person who feels that they're kind of in the dark and then they become, you know, they enter into the light of God, that's their perspective of enlightenment. For the individual who believes in science, it has more of a scientific connotation. Now, when we looked at our survey and we looked at all the different words that people used, what we ultimately came away with were five basic elements of the enlightenment experience. So I'll go through them briefly. One of them is a profound sense of intensity. The idea that this is the most intense experience that a person has ever had. So sometimes it's the most intense feeling of love, or it's the most beautiful music they ever hear. Whatever it is, it's something that is just beyond the most intense thing that they have ever experienced. Another aspect is a sense of clarity. And this is the notion so many people say that when they have this experience is that they get it for the first time. They understand what the world is all about, what they're all about, and what they're supposed to do in life. So that sense of clarity is also a very fundamental concept and a very fundamental part of these experiences. The sense of unity is another critical piece of these experiences, the sense of becoming one with God, with the universe, with some type of universal consciousness. And that is, again, another core component of these kinds of experiences. And the fourth core component, at least in terms of the experience itself, is a slightly different concept, which is the notion of surrender, the notion that they themselves are not making this experience happen, but it's basically something that's happening to them. They are going along for the ride, and they essentially have to surrender themselves to that entire process. The fifth element of the enlightenment experience is not so much an experience, so much as the result, which is the permanency of it and the radical transformation that occurs as part of the experience. So for people who have enlightenment, they go from one way of looking at the world to a fundamentally different way of looking at it. So maybe they thought, you know, whatever they thought was important before, now they know what's important and it's something completely different. And it changes the way they think about their lives, about their health, about their well-being, about their relationships, about their job, and ultimately about their religious and spiritual beliefs. But all of those things seem to change in literally moments. And that to me is also a very fascinating aspect of these experiences, not only because from the perspective of the experience itself, but also from the perspective of the human brain and how it seems to change so radically as a result of these experiences.
Yeah, I found it so fascinating reading the stories. Some people described, you know, enlightenment feeling more real than everyday reality. I don't really know what that means, though.
Well, you know, that was actually one of the things that was very important to me, because that had to do, going back to your very first question about, you know, was I always asking these kind of existential questions? And part of what I felt was so essential is, how do we know what's real? And when we start to think about that from a brain perspective, ultimately, we're sort of trapped within our brain, and we're always looking out on the world, and our brain is interpreting the world around us and trying to make some sense out of that. And so how do we assess what is real and what is not? And I think the best example of that is, if that everybody can relate to, is the dream state. So when you're having a dream, and I'm sure everyone has had this experience, where the dream feels incredibly real, whatever it is, you know, whether you're, you know, vacationing in Paris, whether you're being chased by some monster, whatever it is, when you're in that dream, it feels incredibly real. And your body and your, or at least your mind, is reacting to whatever it is. If there's a guy with a gun who's chasing you, at least in the dream, you're running. And you're running as if that person is real. Now, when you wake up, the very first thing that we say is, oh, that was just a dream. We immediately recognize the dream state as a kind of inferior form of reality.
Yeah.
And by whatever, you know, characteristics we apply to it, we say, no, this everyday reality is the real reality. And that dream state is no longer the real reality. Now, when people have these enlightenment experiences, they look at the everyday reality in much of the way we look at the dream state. So suddenly they feel like now they get it. They really understand the real reality. And the way that we normally think about reality in our everyday world, that's not really that real. There's elements of it that are real, but just like our dream states don't feel real, suddenly our everyday reality doesn't feel as real. And so people do describe it as being a more intensely real state. And that's part of why they feel like it's intense. They feel that they derive clarity. And usually part of that unbelievable sense of realness is associated with that sense of unity, of becoming part of that realness as part of the experience.
Yeah. And there are clearly different paths to that same experience. And, you know, what about drug-induced enlightenment? You know, Abraham Maslow used to call those unearned peak experiences.
Right. Well, you know, there's a lot of very interesting information that comes out of those experiences for us, and people are trying to study them more and more, and even, you know, we've looked at them in the context of our survey. There's some really interesting aspects that come out about it, both in terms of the biological as well as the spiritual. So, you know, from a biological perspective, part of what's important is that we know where these drugs go. I mean, we know certain drugs like LSD go to the serotonin system and affect different chemicals in the brain, and that's part of what leads to that kind of very intense experience for that individual. So that's part of it, which it tells us a little bit about what parts of our brain are involved in these experiences. But the other thing is that when people have these experiences, even though, you know, I think our Western perspective is that they're not real, when people have those experiences, they do recollect them and they do feel that they represent some very fundamental perspective on reality and something which often can transform them and change their lives in many of the same ways that a more natural enlightenment experience can actually do that. In some of the work that I've been doing with David Yaden, who's been one of my students and colleagues, you know, he's looked at how these experiences are described and found that they're every bit as real, as intense, as spiritual as the more naturally occurring ones, so to speak. And yet, you know, obviously they're part of this drug-induced experience. Some of the work that's been done by another colleague of mine down at Johns Hopkins, Roland Griffiths, has found similar things by actually inducing these experiences in people and finding that they represent these perhaps the most intense experiences that these people have had. And the one other piece that I'll add to this, which to me is always important because it gets back to the realness piece, is that, you know, there are many shamanic cultures around the world that use different, you know, use mushrooms and peyote and all that to induce these kinds of states. And for them, these are the windows into that spiritual realm. And the analogy that I always thought about for myself is, you know, I have very poor vision. So when I wake up in the morning, the world is a very blurry place, and I put my glasses on and suddenly I see the world clearly. Well, the world hasn't changed, and I haven't changed. It's just that I am now seeing the world better. And so one might make the argument that by taking one of these drugs, that you're allowing your brain to see the world in a more accurate, more real kind of way.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, it's not that it's a fake vision of the world. It's just that you've now allowed your brain to get to some level of activity that can perceive the world in a way that it's really meant to be perceived. So there's different perspectives that people could take on it.
Did you do a lot of LSD in your day?
I actually have never done LSD. And you know, again, part of the reason why I actually haven't is the notion that I don't know if that perspective on reality necessarily is, you know, based on everything that we understand about how our brain works. If we're always trapped within our brain, then any experience we have of reality, whether it's a dream state, a drug-induced state, a near-death experience, a mystical experience, these are all experiences that we have of reality. So even though they might give us a new perspective, they don't necessarily get us any closer to answering the question about what is the true nature of reality. And so to me, that's still part of my kind of larger philosophical, spiritual, and scientific journey that is looking into that kind of a question. And hopefully someday I might find an answer, but at the moment I haven't. As I always tell everybody, if I ever figure it all out, I'll certainly let everybody know. But I think that the only way that we're going to get to those kinds of answers is through some type of very multidisciplinary integrated approach, which I think neurotheology may have the best option or the best opportunity for us to figure out how to answer those questions. Whether it will or not, I don't know, but I'm going with that for the moment.
Cool. What's the difference between Big E and Little E?
So, the Big E and Little E, when it comes to enlightenment, is a way that we were thinking about it to help people understand the variety of enlightenment experiences, and also to give people a little bit of a sense of what enlightenment is. The little E experiences are experiences that all of us have had. They can be those little aha moments where we suddenly figure something out in life, where we suddenly know, you know, what job to take, what person to marry, a new way of thinking about the world in some particular way. So those are those little aha, little eureka moments. They have different terms that we all have had, you know, maybe some more than others, but we've all had at least a few of them in our lives. And they give you that little taste of what an enlightenment experience is about. You get that moment where you suddenly get something, you feel something a little bit more intense, a little bit more emotional, a little bit more connected to the world in some way, a little bit more clarity that comes out of it. And it changes the way you think about things. The difference is in the Big E enlightenment, the sort of the truer enlightenment experiences, these are experiences that aren't changing the way you think about the world. They're changing basically everything that you know and understand about the world and about yourself. So, you know, in many ways, these experiences are the most intense kind of experiences that we can have. And they are the experiences that we really kind of typically think of when we think about the enlightenment experience. And that's why we refer to them as the Big E experiences, the ones that really change and transform a person's life and a person's way of thinking about things.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds good. I want to get the Big E.
Well, that would be always the ultimate goal, I would think.
But you argue there's kind of like a spectrum of human awareness, that there are various levels of awareness or levels of reality along the way to enlightenment. Can you tell me what lies on that spectrum?
Well, yes. I mean, the spectrum of awareness has to do a lot with our consciousness, and it really does range from the very kind of basic ways of looking at the world and responding to the world in almost an instinctual kind of way, all the way through the more how we sort of make decisions and think ourselves through kind of what we talk about, like intentionality and a way of sort of planning for our world, which is kind of in our everyday reality, our everyday mindsets, and then ultimately up to the more creative ways of thinking about the world. And that's almost where you're getting to that higher consciousness, that notion of creating something new, coming up with something different than has ever been thought of before. You know, that's like a slightly higher level of awareness and perceptions about consciousness. And then ultimately all the way up to this sort of more transcendent nature of consciousness, where we actually get beyond our ego self, that we get beyond how we actually normally think about the world, and feel this incredible sense of connectedness and oneness of our consciousness with the consciousness of everyone else, or perhaps even a universal consciousness, as certain traditions like Buddhism and Hinduism have actually suggested. So there's this kind of transition that goes all the way through these different stages. And as with all of the things that we've been talking about, we can start to relate these back to different brain processes. So, you know, when you talk about our instinctual processes, you're talking about our sensory areas of our brain and our very basic emotional responses. When you start talking about the way we think about things through sort of a conscious intention and decision making, we're talking about our frontal lobes and our temporal lobes that help us to sort of think through things and concentrate on things. And then when we get into these mystical types of states, where consciousness changes into this other kind of altered state of consciousness in the sense of oneness, then we're talking about changes going on at the level of our parietal lobes that help us with our sense of self, and also our frontal lobes in terms of how they begin to actually shut down as we kind of surrender to the experience itself. So we can get into a lot of how our brain is working as we start to think about the subjective nature of these different aspects and the experiences that we have.
Yeah, that's a lot of information that you just gave everyone, and it's super fascinating. My friend Daniel Bohr wrote a delightful book, The Ravenous Brain, arguing that that frontal parietal brain network is kind of the seat of consciousness, is the strongest correlate of consciousness, because it allows you to hold patterns in working memory, and everything is chunking, basically, in his model. We chunk right. The world down, and that the frontal parietal lobe is very important for holding that kind of information in a working memory state. It's a technical book, but it's also a really interesting book. But it seems to me, like, what's kind of confusing to me is you're saying, like, the highest level of enlightenment involves deactivation of literally the frontal parietal network, and yet you're also saying it's, like, higher levels of consciousness. So how can that brain network that is seems to be the most strongest correlate of consciousness, the more deactivated it is, the more enlightened we are? Do you see what I'm saying? I'm trying to understand that.
Well, yeah, I mean, the short answer is we're not totally sure. You know, the more complex answer is that, you know, the brain is always dynamic. It's always changing. And part of what we think is going on is that as you get to sort of higher and higher levels of consciousness, you do kind of ramp up the activity in the frontal lobe, for example. And in fact, the analogy that we were using is that, you know, if you were to climb up a step and jump off, not much happens to you. If you climb up a ladder and jump to the ground, well, you know, you'll feel that. You know, you might be okay, but you'll feel that. But if you climb all the way up a ladder and then you jump into an emptied swimming pool and you fall, you know, another 10 feet down, you're probably going to get hurt. I mean, there's something pretty significant is now going to happen to you. And so part of what we think happens is that there are many different states of consciousness. And so some levels of consciousness do involve of an increase in that frontal lobe activity as we concentrate, as we focus our mind on whatever it is that we're consciously aware of. But then when we get to a point where our ego consciousness actually seems to disappear, then it seems to be associated with a profound drop of activity in this frontal lobe area. And we've seen evidence for that on some of our brain scan studies where people have that kind of an experience. But it does raise some very interesting questions about where exactly is consciousness. And I appreciate one model being the idea of the frontal parietal connection as being part of it. But there are lots of other parts of our brain that may have something to do with our awareness of the world. There's the thalamus, for example, which is a very central structure that brings in our sensory information and relays it up to the frontal and the parietal lobes. So that may be part of our awareness and part of our consciousness. You know, there's our emotional centers, which may have something to do with our memory and our ability to think about things and feel about things. And the other piece of this, and we've talked about this a little earlier about sort of the animal world and animal models of this, is that when you think about it, I mean, animals have a certain level of conscious awareness as well. And even animals that almost don't even seem to have a brain, I mean, ants, you know, they don't eat themselves. They'll eat something else. So there's some sense of self, some sense of awareness of the self and the relationship between that self and the world that seems to kind of keep growing and changing as it goes through different animal species all the way up into human beings. So my guess is that it's very complex. And again, I hope that more research in neurotheology will be able to help us to truly understand what these relationships are. Maybe if we take those individuals, those Buddhist meditators who are perhaps the most adept at modifying their consciousness, maybe we can get a better feel for what's going on in the parietal lobe, in the frontal lobe, and how that varies and changes as an individual goes through life, as they go through meditation, as they go through enlightenment, and really try to get a sense as to how these different brain areas are ultimately related. But consciousness is certainly a huge, huge question. There's, you know, obviously there's a whole field of consciousness studies. And I think neurotheology bumps up to that very, very well and in a very interesting ways, because there's a lot of interesting implications, not only for the brain and consciousness, but for our religious and spiritual selves as well.
Oh, no, I definitely agree. There's just a lot of unanswered questions about this. Like, you know, you find in the intelligence literature that for those who with low IQ scores, when they take an IQ test, you see an awful lot of activity in the prefrontal cortex.
Right.
But for those with very, very high IQs, you actually see reduced activity.
Yes.
Because it's an efficiency issue.
Exactly.
Now, I wonder how much of what you're finding is an artifact of, you know, expert meditators are kind of just becoming more efficient in their usage of the prefrontal cortex.
Well, that very well may be. I mean, we actually did one study that was kind of interesting in regard to that, which was our study of Brazilian mediums. What was interesting about that study is we had 10 different individuals come up from Brazil to study them. And after when we looked at all of the information, we scanned them while they were in this intense trance state, and then we scanned them while they were in just kind of a regular state. And what we found was that we didn't see very much changing when people were in the trance state. We couldn't figure out what was going on. And so we said, well, are there differences between these people? And it came out in our discussion with them that there were 5 individuals who were highly adept and highly practiced and been doing this for years and years. And then there were about 5 people who were relatively new at it, pretty novice at it. And when we divided that into looking at the areas of the brain that we thought would be involved, like the frontal lobe and the parietal lobe, we saw a very interesting dichotomy between these 2 groups of individuals. Those individuals who were very adept at it, kind of what you were just saying with regard to intelligence, the areas of the brain like the frontal lobe and the parietal lobe during the trance state actually decreased in activity.
Yeah.
Whereas in the novices, it actually increased. And I think, you know, that to me, one of the best maybe analogies to that is playing the piano. As I learned to play the piano when I was a kid, you know, when you first start out and you're playing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, you have to concentrate on every note that you're playing. So you're going to increase the frontal lobe activity. Once you ultimately develop enough skill that you can kind of play the piano even without thinking about it, even, you know, certainly like a concert pianist, you know, they don't have to think about it. And so not only is it an efficiency aspect, but it becomes so natural for them that their frontal lobe activity and some of the and their motor activity actually can decrease as part of the process, especially when they become very creative in the process. So I think that we're ultimately talking about some very complex dynamics in terms of how the brain works, how it changes and shifts depending on what we're doing, depending on how we have learned and trained our brain to do these different tasks and to engage these different experiences. And so I definitely think that there is a kind of training process that is part of it that that does change the brain. And there's other data that certainly support that as well, that those people who are long-term meditators who've been meditating for, you know, 15 plus years on a daily basis, they have fundamentally different brains than people who are non-meditators. And it includes changes in the frontal lobe, changes in the thalamus. And so we are able to see where those changes occur and understand that these changes occur as the result of these practices.
Yeah. So what makes you so sure about the brain is giving you useful information here? I mean, you could imagine a really spiritual person who believes in God, a very religious person would say that, like, you know, this kind of stuff lies outside the realm of brain activations, that you're getting in touch directly with some sort of higher being that is not going to be reflected by brain scans. How do you respond to that sort of thing?
Well, actually, I mean, as I have said before, to me, the thing that would actually excite me more than anything is for somebody to say to me, I had the most amazing spiritual experience I've ever had. And when I look at their brain, nothing's changed, because then maybe I really would have captured something spiritual. But short of that, you know, what I usually say to people is that even if there is something that's spiritual outside of the brain, which I have no problem with, I mean, you know, from a neurotheological perspective, I think neurotheology has to be open to both sides, and we have to be open to God's existence, to the spiritual realm. That doesn't mean, you know, that's the ultimate conclusion that we wind up taking, but we have to be open to what those different perspectives are about. But irrespective of whether or not, you know, a nun is literally in God's presence or a Buddhist is literally connected to a universal consciousness that we can't measure, what we can say is, well, but how did that affect their brain? How did they ultimately make some sense out of it, make meaning out of it? How did it change the way they felt, the way they thought, the way they understood the world? So there's always still that more cognitive, emotional, experiential element that can be looked at in the context of the human brain. But, you know, for somebody making that argument, there, it is a valid argument. And the question ultimately is, the analogy I always think about is you know, a boat on the ocean. So am I looking at the boat itself, or am I just looking at the wake that the boat leaves? And, you know, we don't know for sure. Neurotheology may ultimately, by continuing to give us data and information about the subjective nature of those experiences, as well as the biological elements associated with them, may ultimately lead to an answer that could address both sides of the equation. But we do have to be careful. And of course, you know, I always warn people of that, you know, so many times when some of my research has come out, you know, the religious people say, ah, you know, you see there, that's where God has his influence in our brain. And then, the atheist would say, aha, you know, it's purely produced by the brain. And I always try to say, well, you know, it could be either of those explanations. We have to be a little bit more cautious about how we interpret what these studies and what these scans ultimately mean.
Yeah. But your scans are showing that this state of enlightenment certainly involves, when people say they're experiencing these common set of characteristics that resemble enlightenment, it seems like it's a fundamental shift in or suspension of their ordinary view of the world.
Well, I think so. And again, I mean, that is something that happens subjectively. And it also makes sense in the context of that frontal lobe change that we were talking about a few moments ago. You know, our frontal lobes, among many of their functions, you know, basically help to keep all of our ideas in their proper place. It's sort of the big, you know, filing system in our brain that, you know, the frontal lobe sort of helps us maintain that index and make sure we know where everything is. So when we meet our friend, we know that their name is Scott. When we meet our mother, we know her name. We know who these people are. We know our ideas. And the frontal lobe kind of keeps all of that very well organized for us. However, when the frontal lobe suddenly shuts down, it's almost as if you take those file cabinets, throw all the folders up into the air, and then quickly rearrange them back into the file cabinets. And suddenly, we don't think about the world in anywhere near the same way that we did a few moments before. So I think it is part of that whole process about how we utilize our brain to help us understand the world and how that can be radically changed by the nature of these experiences.
Yeah. And there's lots of different, as you say, there's lots of different ways to get to these experiences. So maybe one can listen to music and feel this kind of great sense of awe or transformation, or maybe a medium could do so. You've studied mediums, right, in the brain scanner?
Yeah. So, you know, we have looked at many different kinds of practices. And in our survey, as you mentioned, you know, I was fascinated by this incredible variety of ways in which people wound up getting into these experiences. And as you mentioned, some through music and creativity, some through drug-induced experiences, some through near-death experiences. One of my favorite ones was the guy who basically was driving his truck down the street and it just hit him. So, you know, that doesn't happen very often, but it can. And so one never really knows exactly how or when or where these experiences will come about. You know, part of what we talk about in our book is the ability to try to prime the brain, if you will, towards having those experiences. Obviously, one can never guarantee enlightenment in any way. But the idea of pursuing these kinds of practices and sort of consciously and purposely exploring these questions and trying to explore these experiences is something that virtually everyone can do. So while enlightenment may not happen to everyone, everyone can ultimately experience it. But, you know, we ultimately have to see as we go forward how well people ultimately can get to those kinds of experiences.
Well, let's talk about how anyone could prime the brain to have more of these kinds of experiences. You have this kind of multi-step program, so to speak, how to do that. Can you give some advice?
Sure. Well, I think that there's a couple of very basic things that almost anybody can do, and people can literally start, you know, today down the path. And I think the first thing is basically to understand what enlightenment means to you, you know, what the person is looking for as far as that experience goes. And I think also to sort of prepare themselves for that experience, you know, to, even though it is an incredible experience, to radically change who you are is a scary thing. And so that there's a certain degree of preparation that you have to be kind of willfully interested and be consciously approaching that kind of process. And you have to be kind of prepared and ready for that kind of process. So that's part of it. I think the most important from the perspective of the individual is to find that exact approach, find the ritual as we talk about it, and maybe more than one, but to find that ritual or rituals that will ultimately lead you as an individual down the path towards those experiences. And whether that is something that's creative, whether it is through questioning things, whether it is through meditation, whether it is through the church, whether, you know, whatever it is for that individual or some combination of things, finding that individual process, if you will, is the key. And that is always obviously the biggest challenge. But to start down a path, to keep moving down that path, to be open and aware of other paths and keep an open mind to the different experiences and different paths that might be out there, all of that is part of that process. And then ultimately, surrendering oneself to that process, I think, is very key. That ultimately, you kind of, even though you're purposely trying to get to something, there has to be this moment where you kind of release yourself and allow yourself to just have that experience. And then ultimately, to kind of reflect back on what these experiences are and how they ultimately are something that can be incorporated into your life and what it means to be, so to speak, an enlightened being. How you use that information in terms of your relationships, in terms of your job, in terms of your sense of spirituality. Those, to me, are all very, very critical parts of the process. And again, I mean, it's obviously never a guarantee, but there are ways in which people can do that and kind of purposely do that. And those are some of the easy steps to take right off the bat, you know, just going home and writing down what you think enlightenment means and thinking about the paths that you might take. What are the rituals that you might pursue? What are the things that you do now and or the things that you might try and continue to explore? And I think that's ultimately, you know, to me, that's the fundamental basis of neurotheology, is this sort of what I call a passion for inquiry, that the idea that we just keep asking questions, that we keep pursuing the answers to those questions. And I think that that's part of neurotheology. I think it's part of spirituality. I think it's part of science. I think it's part of enlightenment.
I mean, this really gets at the kind of the heart of human existence and what makes us feel purposeful and meaningful in life. You, as you note, that the state is intimately tied with meaning. And so it seems almost like enlightenment is so individualized per person, depending on their own unique source of meaning and the interpretations they make of what they're viewing in the world. Is that right?
Well, yeah, you know, it's interesting because when we look at these, you know, couple thousand people's experiences and how they wrote the narratives about them, on one hand, we can get to those certain core elements, that sense of unity and clarity and so forth. But each of them also has a profound uniqueness to them. And so, yes, I mean, no one actually has the same exact enlightenment experience. And it also raises some interesting neurotheological questions, too, which is, you know, if somebody in the midst of that experience feels a force and someone feels God and someone feels love, are they the same experience that is then interpreted in three different ways? Or are they fundamentally different experiences that are simply all labeled as enlightenment? And those are some big questions that neurotheology has yet to figure out.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about some of the benefits of what are some of the outcomes you find from people who go through this process?
Well, when we question people about what happened to them afterwards, what we do typically find is that many aspects, many facets of their life have changed, and almost always uniformly for the better. So their sense of meaning and purpose in life is enhanced and grows. Their sense of spirituality is enhanced and grows. The sense of their relationships and the importance of relationships in their lives and how their relationships go improves. Their ideas about their job and vocation improve. And it's really pretty dramatic. I mean, only about a couple of percent, 3 or 4% at most, in any of those categories actually describe a worsening as the result of these experiences. Mm. So, you know, over 90% in general found some kind of improvement in their life as the result of these experiences. So they are incredibly powerful. And to some degree, you know, and I know I'm biased because of the work that I've done, but it seems to me like, you know, and I think you said this too, is that it's the kind of experience that virtually everyone should want to try to find a way to get. And I think that the data suggests that anyone can have it. I mean, again, these couple thousand people, these are not the Buddhas of the world. These are not the, you know, St. Teresa's. These are, you know, these are just everyday people. And so I think one of the big take-home messages of our book and of this work is the notion that it's within all of us. All of our brains have the potential ability to have these experiences. And whether we, you know, purposely try to get to them, whether we take the easier way out, perhaps through a drug-induced experience, whether it happens in a near-death experience, whatever it is, we all are capable of getting to those experiences. And that's what I think the data bears out. And I think that to me is very exciting, because it ultimately can lead all of humanity to an enlightened state, an enlightened sense of our species. And I think that would be wonderful. Like, we certainly need to get to something a little bit better than where we are right now. So.
Agreed. That would be wonderful. Thanks for chatting with me today and for the incredible work that you've done in your long career and the work you're continuing to do. Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barrett Kaufman. I hope you found this episode just as thought-provoking and interesting as I did. If you'd like to read the show notes for this episode or hear past episodes, you can visit thepsychologypodcast.com.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.